Did you know that it's illegal for police to interrupt a church service in the Netherlands? Fun fact, don't you think? I'll get back to that. I need to tread carefully for a moment. I'll start by saying, religion is one of the most divisive topics on the planet. For some reason, there always seems to be an oppositional nature when theologies don't align. A quick look through world history would indicate that many wars, where countless lives have been lost, have been fought in the name of one god or another. I don't need to name any specific wars, conflicts, or genocides, but take a look around the world right now. If evil is being committed, religion is probably in the mix. To put my bias right at the front here, I'm an atheist, but I do find theology fascinating, and I can make sense of a human's desire to believe in something. To have faith. But faith, by definition, is the belief in something without proof or evidence. And it can be a powerful motivator as people desperately seek meaning in an apparently pointless existence, or as they desperately seek guidance on morality in a world where ethics can sometimes be debatable. This desperation can make people vulnerable. When someone can justify genocide because of religion, it doesn't take an atheist to point out how wrong that is. When someone can, say, I don't know, assume top office in the most powerful country in the world on a platform of outright fascism where he is worshipped like a god by his followers, where he falsely stands behind a Bible as if it justifies anything when he acts in an ungodly manner, and still have millions, tens of millions, of supporters who vote for him despite it being certainly against their best interests, we realize how powerful religion can be as a tool to do evil in this world. The Night of the Hunter also demonstrates this evil that can use religion to hide in plain sight, fooling vulnerable people who are then exploited, or worse. Robert Mitchum's Preacher Powell is an obviously evil man. He doesn't really bother too much to hide it for too long, but with his combination of preacher's clothes and confident delivery of parables, even if they are silly or nonsensical, he has the tools to win over key people in this small town, leading to a continuation of his killing spree, which he thinks is in the name of God. As Powell points out in Conversation with God in the movie, God doesn't mind the killing. There's plenty of that in his book. The tragedy is, the average townspeople in the film mean well, and they want to feel like good people. After all, that's what prayer is for in a lot of ways, feeling good about something without tangibly doing anything to improve a situation. Religion is one of the most divisive and foul things in the world, building entire institutions to control people and commit untold amounts of evil upon us all. But it doesn't have to be that way, as Rachel Cooper demonstrates in the film. She believes in a god, but she doesn't just pray to her god begging for help, and she doesn't just trust anyone who tells her they are a Christian or a good person. Rachel is wise, determined, and will not suffer evil. And she puts her values into action, taking on about half a dozen children who are not her own to give them as good a life as she can manage during the Great Depression. That is what religion can be if we understand that we draw morality from our love for each other, not from a religious text. Religion can offer people hope in an afterlife, a hope that things will be better for them if they are good people, and can offer them faith in something bigger than themselves. But a person needs to also live those values consistently. A person needs to put their beliefs into action. Which makes me think of the Tamrazian family. They are Armenian, and the father of the household, Sassoon, was a political activist. Fearing for their lives, they fled Armenia and headed to the Netherlands, where they lived for 9 years, raising their family in a better way of life. But the government decided to deport the family back to Armenia. The family feared for their life, and they turned to a place they felt they could be heard and helped. They turned to the church. And the church responded. Remember what I said about police not being allowed to interrupt a church service legally? They housed the Tamrazian family inside the church, and better yet, committed to performing a non-stop church service until the Tamrazians were allowed to stay in the country, legally. Hundreds of priests and preachers descended on the Hague to assist. Churchgoers came and went, supporting the family, keeping them fed, and participated in the services. They did this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, no breaks, continuously, for 97 days. A three-month church service. Eventually, the decision to deport the family was overturned and they were allowed to stay. The goodwill of the church community won the battle against injustice. This is what religion can be when we put our beliefs into action. Religion is largely a tool for evil and exploitation, but it's also a place where community can come together and help each other to live and thrive. And few movies demonstrate that better than The Night of the Hunter, even 70 years later. I'm Bo Nicholson, and this is Movieversaries. Yes, this is Movieversaries. I'm Bo Nicholson. This is where we celebrate and sometimes reevaluate some of the greatest movies ever on a significant anniversary. On this episode, we're discussing The Night of the Hunter, Charles Laughton's only feature film as director on its 70th anniversary. To help me discuss the film, I'm joined by two of our panel. First up, he's a strong tree with branches for many birds. It's Andy Williams. Hello, Andy.
I will take that. You've clearly been speaking to nobody about my teenage years, so I will take the compliment.
Well, that was initially reserved. That one was initially reserved for Violet Hammond, who's not here on this particular occasion. But she did promise that she'll send through some audio, so we'll see if she keeps her promise. We'll
put that. I'm glad to be your backup. In which case,
yeah, you were going to be. He abides and he endures. It's Andy Williams. But I thought this was nicer, so I slotted you in there.
Those endure me rather than me enduring.
And that other voice you can hear laughing in the background, I wish I was leaning on his everlasting arms. It's Ian Buckley. Hello, Ian.
How you doing, guys?
Excited to discuss this film.
Happy to talk about this hideous-looking movie.
Yeah, horrible looking, famously horrible looking movie.
Famously horrible looking movie.
The Night of the Hunter.
With zero scissoring.
Zero scissoring, as we've discussed off mic. I don't know, that won't, like, whatever.
We've been talking about, yeah, I know.
We've been talking about Wicked for good, and, you know.
I just assumed that would come out.
I might throw it in, I don't know. Let's talk about The Night of the Hunter. It's Harry Powell is a man who dresses like a preacher. He calls himself Reverend. He preaches like a preacher. But he kills widows to abscond with their money in Depression-era USA. He's imprisoned for stealing a car. The law doesn't know about the trail of bodies behind him. And he has 30 days in jail. Another family, the Harpers, are about to come into fortune as the father, Ben, killed two men to steal $10,000. He has two young children, John and Pearl. He hides the money before the police arrive and makes the children swear they won't tell anyone, not even their mother, where it is. He is then arrested and sentenced to be hanged, but before he is executed, he shares a bunk with Reverend Harry Powell, and some sleep-talking alerts Harry to the fact that there is a sum of money available if he can get it out of the family. He heads to the Harpers to imprint himself on their small family, their small town, and his ever-growing list of victims. Charles Laughton's only directorial feature was not a critical or financial success at the time, ending his ambitions as a director, but the film has certainly been really re-evaluated with time to be regarded as a certified classic. It has an IMDb rating of 8 out of 10, a Metascore of 97 out of 100, and it ranked equal 25th on the most recent Sight and Sound poll in 2022, alongside Orhassad Balthazar. Let's establish some credentials here, gentlemen. Ian, as the resident American, about this quite American story. What's your relationship with The Night of the Hunter?
So I'm kind of a neophyte when it comes to Night of the Hunter. I saw it for the first time, and I've heard of this movie for a long time. It's a touchstone for so many people, so many filmmakers over the years. It's influential in a lot of different filmmaking traditions, genre traditions, with which I am pretty familiar, but I had just never seen this movie. And that changed when it came out on like a 4K disc last year or the year before. And I was like, you know what? I finally want to see this movie. It's supposed to look fantastic. So what better way to, you know, see how good this 4K disc looks than to get Night of the Hunter and, you know, pop it on. And so I watched it and I was, as we'll get into, shocked at how good it looked. And it's such a striking film. I love the high contrast black and white cinematography. I just love that look anyway in general, and it's employed so well here. We'll get into the production design too, but just the look of this film really swept me away. And it's, you know, it's unlike any other. It's very singular, not just because it's the only one Charles Laughton ever made, but because it's just not like any other movie that came out of 1955. Like it's a very odd duck. And I think in many ways that has led it to aging pretty well, because it doesn't feel like as much of a product of its era as it might otherwise feel. So yeah, I admire this film a great deal. It certainly visually is extraordinarily striking. I really, you know, you talk about kind of like every frame being a painting. There's so many shots that I feel that way about in this movie. And despite being a recent convert, I am a convert. I do think this movie is, has a lot to be admired about it.
For those at home, so we are going to spoil this film pretty early, by the way, because there's plenty that we can talk about with all of that and the themes about this film and how it's executed. But and executed is a strange word to use with this movie. But to peel the curtain back a little bit, I sent through a link to the rest of the panel from a website called Film Grab. So if you go to filmgrab.com and you type in The Night of the Hunter, you'll see a bunch of stills. And as Ian talks about, every frame could be a piece of art. You know, it's a very deliberately shot film to look bizarre and interesting at every occasion. And I don't think anything illustrates it better than this Film Grab page. It's like, it's just phenomenal stuff, quite literally. Andy, what is your relationship with The Night of the Hunter?
So I watched it many, many years ago studying film, because it kind of popped up on a lot of very influential people's favorite film lists. You know, we're talking like the Coen brothers, Martin Scorsese, those sorts of people. And
Roger Ebert?
Yeah, David Lynch, Terrence Malick, like those kinds of directors. So I watched it then, was very impressed with it, and then sort of put it to one side and returned to it this year. This is the second time I've watched it this year, because we did it on my other podcast on Frame to Frame. We took the relatively easy task of pairing it with this other little known, not particularly great movie called Citizen Kane. So that was a...
Have you heard of it?
Yeah, I'm not sure anyone will have, but that was a difficult undertaking. So it's, you know, I'm excited to dig into this film a little deeper with you guys.
Yeah, you poor thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, we chose the theme of actors directing debuts, right? So Orson Welles and Charles Laughton, and you know, Charles Laughton primarily known as a stage actor. Over his career, he got an Academy Award, he got a Grammy, he was nominated for BAFTAs. He was a very highly acclaimed actor from the rip-roaring British town of Scarborough. So he's a very singular figure, both on screen and clearly behind the camera.
Yeah, this really is something. My credentials are far less impressive than both of you. I'm closer to Ian, though, in the sense that I'd heard about it for years. It was one of those things where, you know, I bought the Roger Ebert Great Movies book, where he's got like 100 essays of great movies. And I always skipped the chapter of The Night of the Hunter because I'd never seen it, you know. And it comes in every friggin' film list that you can think of, not just those directors you talk about, Andy, but just, you know, Hallowell's and Empire and Film Magazine, Total Film Magazine, you know, like they all have these. It's very high. It's like it's always in the top 100. And it's my most embarrassing blind spot. It really was. Probably the most embarrassing. I think Ian would argue it might be Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I think this
is definitely Raiders of the Lost Ark.
It's definitely Raiders of the Lost Ark, though. But I felt very similarly until, like, honestly, like when it finally came out on this like pristine home video release, I was like, okay, no more excuses. Like, I gotta get this. I gotta put this on. I gotta like soak this in. And I'm pretty sure I like texted you or left you a voice memo that day being like, I finally saw Night of the Hunter. And we talked about it a little bit, and I'm glad you finally got to have the experience too.
Well, for peel the curtain back, we're running out of time this year to cover films that end that are made in years ending in five. And we got to the point where we're like, okay, we need some non-negotiables. Like from everybody on the panel, we need a non-negotiable. And for me, this was it, because I'm just like, I need the impetus. I need to watch this freaking thing. I did. And I did like it very much. But I will say this. I've watched it twice now, and I liked it a lot more the second time. Because the first time, I think I was a bit off-put by just like tonal shifts. And I think we can get into this a bit more now. As I said, we've given a spoiler warning. So if you haven't seen The Night of the Hunter, leave, go watch it. Don't be like Bo or Ian. Like, watch it when you're young. Watch it when you're young and full of hope. It'll destroy it, maybe, or rescue it. Who knows? And and I watched this movie, and there's a lot that I loved about it. As you said, Ian, lights out photography. It's just like, it looked just brilliant. But there's the very obvious religious themes that I didn't love the jumping between. I didn't love the juxtaposition. I didn't quite get, I guess, the juxtaposition between the Reverend and Miss Cooper, which, you know, is central to the themes of this story, and something that I clicked with a lot better the second time I watched it.
That was going to be my next question, is whether it became clearer the second time, because it definitely did for me.
Because the first time, I think I'm just expecting genre, and it keeps fighting against genre. You know, like when the kids are like down the river, it feels very like safe. What movie am I in anymore? You know, like it does. It feels different. It feels like we were reaching a crescendo in terms of tension, and then it just like drops off and just floats along for 5 minutes quite beautifully. And then the tension rises again. Don't he never sleep? You know, I couldn't quite grab onto it the way I wanted to the first time.
Sure.
Second time I definitely did. And I'm just wondering if that's a experience that you guys shared, or whether it was just like, nah, this is a classic from the get go.
Well, you think I had a long period of time between my first and second viewings. So I think that there is probably something to that. I intellectually appreciated it more than emotionally connecting with it. On second and third viewings, the two that I've done for this year, I definitely connected more with it, to the extent that I wouldn't hesitate to put this in. I hate lists, as you well know, but I wouldn't hesitate to put this in a list of the best movies I've seen this year, whether that be new movies or rewatches. I certainly connected more with the religious themes, the ideas of a false prophet, Americana, all that sort of stuff, which I know we're going to get into. But Ian, what about you?
Yeah, I agree the first time through, and even still when I talk about this movie to people and recommend it, the thing that I talk about first is how striking it is visually. I just can't help it but talk about, you know, I think I was maybe talking to our friend Sam recently, and I said something along the lines of, there are shots in this movie that will just stay with you forever. Like, they're just those kinds of film iconography and cinematography that just make a lasting, profound impression on you if you're a lover of movies. And so that's the first thing I always appreciate about the movie, and that I in rewatching it this time, still felt like, oh my God, like, how did he get, it's 1955. They don't have this isn't even an enormous Hollywood production either. Like, they're just getting these shots, and the confidence in their ability to create innovative imagery out of the resources at their disposal, sometimes on very short notice. Like, we'll get into a bit of the production, but like, sometimes they were deciding what they would do the next day, just the night before. Sometimes they were deciding what their next shot was going to be, you know, hours before. You know, all of these things don't feel like they were created, you know, by the seat of the pants, but you know, they, you know, the spirit of invention comes through in so many of these shots. But visuals aside, I do, especially on second and third viewings, feel more of a connection to, you know, the themes that they're exploring, you know, the, like Andy was saying, the false prophet thing, you know, the, both Lawton, oh my God,
Mitchum,
the star. Robert Mitchum. Both of them were working kind of close collaboration on this character and this piece, so that, you know, they both felt it was important to convey this idea of these, like, hucksters, these charlatans, these people who are taking advantage of the desperate people in this desperate time in our country, and well, in so many countries. But, you know, this is set in Depression era America, when there are many kids, many families who are starving, destitute, experiencing the kind of hardship that it's difficult for many of us to even imagine on a day-to-day basis. Like, most of us can't even imagine experiencing that kind of food insecurity. And in that context, here comes this man dressed in, you know, a shepherd's cloth. And, you know, instead of tending to a flock, he is, in fact, a wolf who is preying upon his flock and taking advantage of the most vulnerable in society. And yeah, the contrast with the widow at the end, who's taking, you know, who's taking in all of these children and taking good care of them. And, you know, she's acting as a true shepherd, and she doesn't need these vestments. You know, she doesn't need necessarily to, you know, put on holy airs. She's just living through, you know, she, you know, in her holiness is through, like, you know, right action and living well and actually tending a flock and just, you know, connecting with, like, her empathy, her goodness, you know, on an emotional level, despite the strange, you know, storytelling methods at times. There's a lot that I find to appreciate about this, especially on repeat viewings.
Ian's touching on a lot of themes there, and I'm going to ask the question to you first, Andy. In, you know, framing it with the, does it hold up 70 years later with those themes? And I guess I'll ask the very direct question: does a film about a psychopath being enabled by a large group of gullible believers because he stands behind the Christian cross? I can't think of a reason why that would hold up in 2025, Andy.
No, the notion of somebody claiming false prophecy and being performative about their beliefs and ultimately having a different goal to what they initially sort of spread throughout the world, I can't see how someone like that would command any kind of attention. especially end up in a kind of position of power.
Especially when they're so transparently false. Like that, like that's the thing that's actually quite striking about this movie, is that it's very silly.
Yeah, he's very performative. Harry, the Reverend Powell is clearly using scripture to justify murder, and using religious language to exploit the vulnerable, usually vulnerable widows. And he frames his lust as God's work. He is twisting sacred words to manipulate others to gain stature, both financially and within the standing of the community. He is absolutely predatory and vicious, whilst being extremely charismatic. And, you know, Robert Mitchum was a movie star. Robert Mitchum was so... He was such a great actor, so, so good. And, you know, his performance in things like Thunder Road, in things like Angel Face, like El Dorado, he was just a brilliant sort of anti-hero type actor. And the way he balances everything from Preacher Powell, you can tell that there's that duality within the character that is... Like I say, it's very clearly out there, but people choose to believe what they see and what they want to believe.
He's got this very sort of snake oil salesman, you know, carnival act, almost kind of like just, you know, he's all about drawing people in, drawing their attention, you know, kind of like overwhelming them almost with his performative nature, and his vocabulary and the way he speaks, it's very intoxicating to people who aren't used to, you know, people who maybe aren't very worldly, they aren't exposed to a lot of these kinds of people, and so they're taken in. And a lot of these people also just want to assume the best, especially if people dressed up as priests. And the fact that he's a man makes an enormous difference in the society that we're seeing depicted. So there are all sorts of social biases at work to make him more believable as well. And when he does the whole like silly love hate thing, you know, he's almost hypnotizing them, right? Like he's doing this act that it's you know, to people who aren't on that wavelength, like you, like the three of us, this shit would not work on. So to us, it seems like this is clown stuff. Why are people being taken in by it? But we see examples of that all the time. And not just in our politicians, but, you know, in our preachers in the year 2025, you know, in these mega churches, like they're these big, larger than life personalities saying outrageous things, making big gestures to enormous crowds of people who are hanging on every word. And if you're not in that big tent, you're like, what is going on in here? Like what is everyone else seeing that I'm not getting? But if you're under the spell, it's intoxicating. And if you are inclined to be predatory, as this man is, it's extremely dangerous.
I think I've told this story to both of you before, but maybe I haven't. But in my mid-20s, so I've always been maybe not as much of an atheist as I am now. But I've never really believed in a god or anything like that, right? Even dating back to childhood. But when I was 25, I was dating this girl who was in one of those evangelical churches. And her family invited me to go down to Sydney, which is a 10-hour drive, to go to a Hillsong conference. It was called Hillsong's the big evangelical church here in Australia. And it's 5 days of like just worship. Like 8 till 8, 5 days a week. And by Wednesday, like we broke up at the car park, right? Like we got back together enough to drive home, and then broke up like a couple of weeks later. It was cooked. But the one thing that I particularly remember, because you're talking about like, oh, it's clown shit, right? Like, we're talking about a stadium that had 22,000 seats, indoor stadium, packed.
Wow.
And in the middle, like a rock concert, like the biggest rock concert, like you can think of Springsteen and like the big names, how they pack those concerts out. They have the stage, the circular stage in the middle, and all the seating on the floor that they put in for that, you know. This was like that. And this guy, and he was a black American, but he was a preacher at one of these, you know, he wasn't like Joel Osteen or one of these churches, but like almost as big. These evangelical American churches. And he was sitting there and he was saying, I'm not going to do the voice because that's racist, but I'm going to just try and match the energy, which is, I am going to give you the love of Jesus, and I am going to shoot you with this bazooka. And to be clear, he's an American, but he's not actually holding a gun. It was just like he sort of pretended he had this made of air bazooka. And I don't think he understood what a bazooka was, because it's more like a rocket launcher than a machine gun. But anyway, he was saying, I'm going to shoot this bazooka. And when you get shot with this bazooka, you're going to feel the power of Jesus. And he goes like in a circle around this. And I promise you, I've been in stadiums like grand finals, last minute clutch plays, 80,000 people cheering and screaming. I have never been in a place so noisy. Like you could have been screaming at the top of your lungs and not heard yourself. It was unbelievable. And I was not screaming. This was Wednesday morning by this point. I'm done.
Only on the inside.
And I'm just like, I'm looking around, and like her parents are like wailing with euphoria, and she's doing it too. And I'm just like, this is clown shit. This is clown shit. He doesn't even know what a bazooka is. You know, it's a machine gun. like, you know,
he didn't even get the gun right. I thought he was American. What the fuck?
I thought he was American. What sort of American doesn't get the gun right? And it was clown shit, but it worked on 22,000 people. I've never felt more alone and scared, frankly. It was the scariest thing I've ever seen in my life, was 22,000 people getting, like, objectively speaking, brainwashed by clown shit. And the sad thing is it works. Like, it works on people. People just want something. They want to believe, you know? They want to believe that everything's going to be okay and there is an afterlife. And if I just do these things, and these charismatic people with their bazookas come in and they're going to make everything feel better. And it's just sad, you know? And I think this film portrays that really interestingly, because I'm not entirely sure that the film positions itself as atheist. I don't think it does. I think it positions itself as fake Christian versus real Christian. And I think it kind of believes in God. I think because of Miss Cooper's character. And I'd be very curious to hear some thoughts about that.
Well, I think it goes back to the old Voltaire maxim of, if God does not exist, then it would be necessary to invent him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the notion of people want that thing to believe in. They want that sense of togetherness that the church creates, that religion creates. I think the film is profoundly religious, and it critiques the false religion rather than religion itself.
Yeah.
And that's where you have Cooper, as played by Lillian Gish, whose casting is fascinating and we'll get into, but
love it.
Yes, but that's where you've got her as the direct opposition to him. She is the woman at the end of the film who takes in the extra children and takes on as many kids as she can, because she helps not by being performative but by being compassionate. And Powell, with his faith, is self-serving and built on fear, whereas Rachel Cooper is very nurturing and protective. But on the whole, I think the film's sort of deep theological stance would be more about the fact that religion reflects the people who are wielding it, as opposed to the idea of fanaticism. You know, Powell is seemingly seeking those ready for manipulation, whereas the film, as in the sort of final message, it shows us moral goodness and the protective power of genuine faith. So that's where I think the binary opposites of Cooper and Powell really come to the fore.
And probably why we needed, the thing that off put me in the first place was, why are we spending this last 3 minutes at Christmas with this sugar syrupy, the ending of Reverend Powell's everything? Like, he gets shot in the arm or something and runs off squealing, and then that's it, and that's the end of the tension. And it's a very bizarre choice, right? But thematically, you need to finish the film like, no, this guy has been a clown the whole time, look at how embarrassing he is, this is true goodness, and we need to finish this story properly. You know, we need to finish Miss Cooper's story properly, which I needed a second viewing to get. But Ian, do you agree with Andy's position that it's a deeply religious film?
Yes and no. I think it is. It's a product of its time, not just the fact that it came out in 1955, but the fact that it's set in, you know, the 20s, 30s. You know, yeah, it exactly. So it is not really feasible to have openly atheistic characters, right, in our feature. Like, that's just not really, you barely see that these days. And so I think for that reason, it wouldn't be reasonable to expect that kind of sort of atheistic ethos. But I think it does reflect, I think, what for a lot of people could be recognized as a kind of practical atheism, in the sense that Miss Cooper and the Reverend are two characters who are using scripture to kind of justify their actions, the way they go about in the world. But she is, because she is fundamentally acting in a more moral way, like, she is acting Christian, recognizably Christian, but, you know, they're both using Christian scripture to justify, you know, to justify their actions. The difference is that, like, she's actually acting properly, but they would both use the same text to justify their actions. So I think it demonstrates to me, especially as a viewer watching it in 2025, that, like, the morality doesn't come from the scripture. The morality comes from the person. They might read scripture and see things in scripture that reflect their inner morality, but it's not the other way around. It's not that these religious truths were revealed and that's why you become a good person. It's actually something quite different. And so I see it as a movie too, that in its portrayal of, like, the townsfolk, particularly as they get taken in by the Reverend early, and then that at the very end are the ones, like, calling for his blood at, you know, at the hands Blue of a mob, beard. You know, like, yeah, like, those are the people that are depicted as, like, your regular, average, everyday Christians, religious people. So I do think it's a film that is critical of at least the way religiosity manifests in a lot of people. I think it has a lot of questions about the way that people are religious. But I would never call it, like, an openly atheistic work. Like, it's not that cynical about religion, but, you know, to go back to the idea about, like, it's holiness through just action. And, you know, like, this lady you know, who loves Jesus and is defending her home full of children with a shotgun is about as American an image as you can evoke in the cinema, especially in 1955. And, you know, I do think there is an acknowledgement for a need to think about how we go about being religious, how we go about being Christian in society, and like how we go about protecting the most vulnerable in society. Like, we allow these, you know, like in 1955, it wasn't part of the discourse in America, but now in 2025, one can't help but think about the, you know, the imagery of a clergyman pursuing children. You know, like we think about like the kinds of, you know, victims that are often like
spotlight
revealed
comes to
years
mind.
Later. Yeah. Mm-hmm. At the, you know, that like, oh, wow, we let people who were wearing these vestments get away with all this awful shit because we made assumptions about their morality because of who they claimed
presented
to be,
as,
who they
yeah.
claimed to yeah. represent, you know, the big man upstairs in the clouds, you know.
That's kind of what I mean by saying it's all deeply religious. Like it's critiquing institutional complacency rather than religion. It's critiquing
it is a lot
the idea
of contempt
of,
for institutions.
Yes. And the idea of not thinking about who you're putting your faith in. It's calling to sort of live authentically rather than believing blindly. But there is a very clear, I think, argument here that the film is a parable. The story is a parable.
Yes,
we don't we don't get the inner complex psychology of the characters. These things come through from performances, but it's never truly explained. Powell just is evil. He is the wolf in sheep's clothing. Cooper just is goodness. She is the shepherd of the lost children. The children are innocence confronted by both sides of that. And I think that it's the simplicity that gives it that structure of a parable. They're not people as much as they are concepts. So that feeds very heavily into how it is religious. Like it's a parable is a moral lesson, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Lawton was really going for, and it uses a lot of imagery that is recognizable. Like you can see the bedroom being lit like a chapel, and the mother's death staged like some sort of martyr's ascension, and
right,
you know, Powell is coming across the horizon like a fable dark rider. It's
leaning,
I think Lawton
leaning it rides along far out.
Yeah,
all the drifting on a river and you know, imagery.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, the Moses of it all. That is, I think, possibly the key scene of the entire film. But I think that given the expressionist lighting, the theatrical lighting, the stylized acting, the shadows, Lawton is intentionally creating a different kind of world. It's not realism in a way. It is very symbolically heavy in a way that folktales would be, in a way that parables would be.
Yeah, you have this storybook atmosphere, deliberately constructed atmosphere. I mean, you think about like the when the kids are on the run at night and they're taking shelter in the barn, you know, the house and the barn are these very clearly artificial kind of stylized impressions of those structures. And, you know,
very German expressionist
kind of. Yeah, exactly. And it's very dreamlike and storybook-like, and it very much evokes, you know, the parable of it all.
Mm. And like, I think I was somewhat penalizing the film the first time I saw it because of things like that. Like, things like bad acting. Because, I mean, like, the kids are the kids, right? The kids got some awkward moments with their acting, right? But even, like, Lillian Gish, who I'm not going to say bad acting, but I'd just say like weird tropey shit, like her talking to herself to explain things to the audience. They abide and they adjure, you know, like stuff like that. I found really like, whoa, like what am I doing here? Like this feels weird. But on the second time around, it was like, no, you're right, Andy. This is a parable. It is very deliberately trying to push me away from realism and trying to get me to understand deeper themes. It's a very deliberate move. And it feels wrong to penalize it for that. Even though, like, yeah, some of the kids' moments are a bit, you know, don't, you know, like stuff like that. Like, I find that hard to believe.
Well, I think, you know, Lillian Gish is probably a relatively unknown name to most people, but in
legend though,
in 1927, she was dubbed the first lady of the screen by Vanity Fair. She is key in the history of acting within the United States. She's probably closely associated with D.W. Griffith and The Birth of a Nation and Intolerance.
Broken Blossoms.
I think that her casting in this is very clearly harking back to her silent days. Like she is the innocence of the past, and she provides not only as an actor giving us sort of the credibility of her performance and her persona, but she's archetypically good, and she portrayed very often innocent, enduring women in the face of danger. You mentioned Broken Blossoms. So by having her cast here, it immediately in 1955 brought with it expectations. It immediately brought with it the baggage of her previous career. So given that she is the antithesis of Powell, her character, she becomes the moral center of the film, not just by the way that the film is portraying it, but also by the baggage and the fact that it is Lillian Gish that was being cast.
It's worth mentioning that all three of the leads, when you include Shelley Winters, at this point in history, were Oscar-nominated performers. So Lillian Gish went from being, as you rightly say, like the queen of silent film, very unarguably on the Mount Rushmore of silent film performers, especially for women. Then she went sort of more into stage for a long time. Once talkies started to become a thing, she was still doing films, and she had, you know, an Oscar-nominated performance in the 40s, I want to say, for Jewel in the Sun.
46.
So when you have Shelley Winters as well, who was also Oscar nominated for A Place in the Sun in the early 50s, you have Robert Mitchum, of course, who was nominated for Story of G.I. Joe in the 40s. It's a pretty well-regarded cast. Shelley Winters goes on to win two competitive Oscars, and Lillian Gish got an honorary one later in her career. But, I mean, heck of a cast. Like, it's not bad work when you consider the fact that you've got, you know, a lights out performance from the cinematographer. You've got Robert Mitchum at his most dastardly, and then you've got Shelley Winters and Lillian Gish in there. I would probably put Lillian Gish second billing over Shelley Winters, but that's where I differ from the film. But I wanted to get some thoughts about Shelley Winters' performance. There's a couple of things here. One is the behind-the-scenes knowledge that Robert Mitchum hated her, like capital H hated her, to the point that he very, very in poor taste said that he wished that shot under the water was actually her and not a dummy, which is not funny and horrible and worth mentioning, I think. But also, yeah, factoring in the performance, how wildly, again, unrealistic it is, kind of, I think. Ian, what are your thoughts on Shelley Winters?
I think it's one of those situations where it is a good thing that they were not going for realism in this, because then I think it would be something that you might bump against. I think, you know, at least when it came to the casting process, Robert Mitchum, I don't know how it sounded like he didn't conduct himself that well during production, but in the pre-production process, his major concern that he voiced was just that she wouldn't come across as, you know, believably a kind of Midwestern hick in the Depression. She's like this New York hot actress who's, you know, just the, like, she just, he was worried the audiences wouldn't buy her as the character she was portraying. But I think her, this sort of like odd, detached performance is in keeping with the sort of storybook dream logic of the whole affair. I mean, their relationship develops over the course of two scenes, maybe. I mean, it's just it moves faster than anyone would actually believe in a more realistic film. So I think it's not really something that sticks out to me like a sore thumb because of the movie that contains it. But I could also see why some people would look at it and go, that's a, it's a weird performance, or there's something off about that performance. But to say that it's not realistic would kind of miss the point of the movie at large.
Mm. And maybe she's like slightly hamstrung by the fact, like, you know, like when she's about to be murdered and she's laying in bed with her arms crossed, you know, like it's very religious looking imagery, and maybe that hamstrings the performance a little bit.
I mean, it's affected, but I think that it's not a performance that, like, I didn't watch it and think that I was getting a performance that Charles Laughton didn't want. I'll say that. Like, I didn't feel like she was screwing up her assignment. You can maybe argue that maybe he should have cast someone else. I don't know. Maybe someone else would have done something different and more interesting, but it didn't feel to me, especially knowing that this is someone who can act well, that it was some misfire or mistake on her part. I just feel like this is what Charles Laughton wanted from her. You know, he himself was an extremely experienced and well-regarded actor. I have a really difficult time believing that he was unable to communicate what he wanted out of her performance to her.
Yeah, Andy, fair to say Lolita legend Shelley Winter's innocent?
I think when you look at the three central adult performances in the film, you've got, you know, Harry Powell being the center of all evil. You've got Wheeler Harper being sort of melodramatic and the emotional lens for the film. And then you've got Rachel Cooper being far more restrained. And I think when you offset the three against each other, it's the dynamic of tension and morality and emotional resonance between all three of them. By having the balance of Mitchum's expressionistic performance with Shelley Winter's melodramatic performance, and then Lillian Gish's sort of more archetypical, it plays all into the notion of it being a parable, being a fable, and looking at it in that way. And like Ian said, of all of the things in the film that I think Charles Laughton would have got his way on and got exactly what he wanted, it would be the performances.
Hmm. Let me, we're talking about some great elements of the film, and we have talked about photography. Let me give you a wildly hyperbolic take, I think.
Strap yourself in. It's that time again for a wildly hyperbolic take.
Just wanted an excuse to use that.
No, in fact, it was the other way. It was chicken before the egg. I thought of the hyperbolic take, and then I thought, you know what? I'd like to have a jingle for that.
Of course you did.
And then I sat there between, you know, my shift yesterday and going to see Park Chan-wook's new film, thinking I'm gonna put together a jingle. That's what I did with my Friday afternoon. Okay, so my wildly hyperbolic take. Feel free to use this soundbite in future if you have one yourself in future episodes. I think the shot of this movie, and maybe one of the most evocative shots in the history of cinema that I've seen, has to be seeing Shelley Winters's character, Willa Harper, dead in that car underneath the water. Like, I think, and like, the wildly hyperbolic take is that if someone said to me that is the greatest shot in film ever, I'd be like, cool, yeah, I get it. Like, that's, and because like the first time I saw it, right, like you're kind of thinking that she's dead, probably, you know, the switchblade comes out, she's laying there prone, ready to be killed. You hear the car drive away in the middle of the night. You probably assume she's going to be dead. But then there's this element of like, oh no, oh God, it is her. And then there was an element of, wait, this is like really beautiful. Like the way that her hair is like floating in the water, like the seaweed is. And then you're thinking, this is 1955. How are they doing? Is that really her? Is that a dummy? Is that really her? Is this really underwater, or are they somehow mimicking underwater? How would they even do that in 19? How are they doing it? So between like just beautifully composed, it looks stunning. It's dreadfully sad, like overwhelmingly sad, watching a dead body with a slit throat floating in water, but like floating strapped into a car. It's iconic, and it's baffling how they managed to do it. And I've read about it, and it's like, oh, well, that all makes sense. They did it in a tank, whatever, whatever. Like, but like, that is a virtuoso shot. It could be the greatest shot ever. That's my wildly hyperbolic take. Thoughts?
I mean, I'll say, I mean, it was my first time seeing it, and I was truly taken aback by how effective that shot was. The wider one, especially with the very last one, where you can really see the hair flowing and the sea like that. I was really, really struck by.
Yeah. Andy?
I mean, when you're talking greatest shots of all time.
Yeah, I know. This is what makes it a big, it's obviously a great shot.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah. I'll go so far as to, you know, you're absolutely right in the use of the contrast and lighting, making her appear like a martyr. She is sacrificed at this point. And with the shadows showing us, sort of giving us the ability of the imprisonment and the looming evil that the Powell has over the entire film, I'll give you that. One thing I'll point to the Eisenstein film, Battleship Potemkin, from 25, the shot of the woman with the baby being trampled, like,
yeah,
that, yeah, it's far more it's far more kinetic. It's still to this day the textbook example of visual storytelling. The crop duster scene from North by Northwest, even, like, you look at suspense being visualized by the pacing of the camera and the framing. I'd put that one up there. You look at the desert shot from Lawrence of Arabia. Ian, I know you have a particular resonance with that specific shot. I think that whilst it is a phenomenal shot, it's unquestionably a great shot, it is static, and its impact relies on narrative dependence that some of the greatest shots in film history don't. And I don't think it was innovative in the way that some of the others within the course of film history have been. So I would give it to something a bit more like North by Northwest or Battleship Potemkin or something along those lines. But I like the take.
So basically, Andy is just saying,
suck it, Bo.
What about you, Ian?
No, like I said, the first time I saw it, I was truly taken aback by how stunning it was. I mean, I think it's just gorgeous. Yeah, of course it's a static shot, but that's okay too. There's no motion in beautiful photographs, so in my mind, it's almost like looking at like a motion for like a beautiful like photograph that has some motion to it. Just
a little flurry of the hair.
Very evocative. Yeah, and like you said, just deeply melancholic.
Yeah. That clash of like awe, beauty, and melancholia is something that I find hard to match in things that I've seen.
I don't hate the shot. We
get it.
You're having a crack at the take more than
also can't take my like 2025 brain out of it of like, this was 70 years ago. How is this being like? I can only imagine. There's another shot too that I had forgotten about that we'll get to in a bit that also really struck me this time. But there's so many.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you could actually point to a number of different shots in this film. As I said, I talked about film grab earlier. I'm scrolling through it now. Like, the header one they've got is him looking at the wall while she's laying on the bed with the crossed arms. And it's just like, well, that's a great shot. Like, that's a really great shot. There's him in the bunk bed upside down, looking down at Ben Harper. That's a great shot. You got, like, obviously the silhouette through the window of the hat, the man with the hat at that timing. That's a great shot. You've got the periscope view as you lock in on those kids and as they're hiding from him. That's a great shot. Obviously, the silhouette of the little person on the pony, which we actually think is Robert Mitchum on a horse, that's a great shot. Like, there's so many. I mean, even him with his hand on the porch of Miss Cooper with love on his hand.
Yeah.
That's a great shot. Like, it's lights out stuff, but I've got a favorite.
Speaking of lights out, I mean, should I just say what my favorite shot from?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, one of them, I should say, not necessarily my favorite, but the one that really struck me this time is, you know, I was definitely cluing into a couple of the visual tropes in horror movies and thrillers that it feels like were very much cribbed from this film. And one of those moments in particular was when Miss Cooper is sitting, you know, guard on her, I guess it's her back porch or whatever. And Ruby comes in with the light and the reflection of the light obscures the Reverend out there in the yard.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when out she the walks away without the light and he's gone and you're just, ooh. I mean, it just, it's so effective and it's so, you can so clearly see the line. I don't know if it was the first time a shot like that was done, but it's one of those things that I can imagine future director after future director seeing and going, ooh, that was good. That was good. And there's a couple of those moments like this, like that in the film where you can see how that shot there was a direct influence on all of these films down the line. But that shot in particular this time really, really got me. I was like, wow, what a great moment.
Yeah. When Powell is at the gate and he's kind of silhouetted, it is so beautifully composed and blocked. When Lawton's using sort of diagonal lines across the frame, whether it be the fence, whether it be the shadows, the use of light, it's just brilliant. The symbolism of the whole thing, it's show don't tell filmmaking. You know, the gate being the threshold, everything is safe this side of the gate, and there is evil the absolute other side of the gate. So, with then Rachel kind of being the guardian protecting her flock. It's kind of on the nose, but also it's beautiful visual storytelling.
It's
an unbelievable shot for a first time director as well.
Yeah,
amazing. And there was so much show don't tell, even with like some of the recurring themes, like the sexual repression that Lawton clearly wanted to explore as much as he could in 1955.
The erect switchblade.
It, in the movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like literally a hate boner bursting through the fabric.
Through his pocket.
You know, like,
not sure I've heard powerful... that phrasing before. What? Hate boner.
Yeah, like is that a what thing? An image. Oh, you've never heard the term hate boner? Yeah, it's a term that I've heard before, but I mean, I invented it. I'm very clever. And I
believe that too. Like
you have, you know, his hate hand like gripping the pocket knife and it just ejects through the fabric of his clothes. Just things like that he finds like single images, single shots to convey deeper thematic meaning. I just really, really appreciated all those touches, especially on repeat viewing.
And one thing I'm noticing with Film Grab, because it puts all the... It sounds like an advertisement for Film Grab. I promise I'm not getting paid for this. they put all these random shots, not really random, but like a collection of shots throughout the film just next to each other. It's like as a wall here, like an Instagram feed. And one thing I've noticed is that a lot of the lighting is very centralized in the frame, and the frame has like just dark edges in so many of the shots. And I just wonder if that was just a stylistic choice, or whether it's saying something more about how, like, there's always darkness or evil, you know, you're surrounded by it, or like it's always on the edge of the frame, it's just lurking, it's just always there, you know, and you have these pops of light in the middle, or maybe a window frame or something, but just generally speaking, it's just surrounded by darkness, all these little shots. It's so evocative and so brilliant.
Do you guys think, one thing I did want to bring up was Lawton, as I mentioned at the top, is British. He's English. Do you think there's something in the fact that it takes an outsider to film the Deep South in this way? Like, what do you think it was that he brought, being British, that outsider perspective to this story?
I'd lean on Ian with that one.
I think as an outsider, particularly a man who was at least publicly closeted, and was maybe in a couple of different ways felt like a little bit of an outsider. Maybe he didn't suffer from as many illusions about the American dream and the larger American narrative, particularly, you know, in the mid-50s during the height of the Cold War. Like, this is not an especially patriotic film. This is not an especially reverent film about the society at large and what it's doing to its most vulnerable and the people who thump Bibles. It's not especially friendly towards them. So like there are many ways in which this is a film without preciousness about certain American popular ideals that were especially being like highlighted at the time, as we were, you know, rah-rah against the dirty commies in the world. You know, there was certainly an effort to be, patriotic in media. And this is, you know, this is not a piece of media that's especially precious about the American dream in 1930s.
Do you have a thesis there, Andy?
I mean, I think that it's more, so I absolutely agree with what Ian's saying. And to sort of expand upon it, I think that Lawton, manages to be freed from the idea of having to depict the real American South. So is then able to filter it through other influences. So he's influenced by Southern Gothic tropes and American literature, this novel being one of the key ones. But he also brings that European sensibility with him in, you know, how often have we already referenced German expressionism? So
just experimental generally, you know, like it defies American ideas of what genre is.
But that's a form thing, whereas from a narrative perspective, it is so deeply American. Like, it couldn't be in any other country with its narrative, but from its form and the way in which it's told, it's a brilliant hybrid of American content and European form.
Yeah, I agree with that. To answer your question about Outside Eyes, you know, like, I feel like if me and Ian both made a movie, apart from the difference of quality, because Ian has more experience with filmmaking than I do, I would say that our views of America, if we were making a film about America, would be wildly different and would have different insights. You know, Ian would be able to provide an insight from inside America and what it's like being there and being subjected to the propaganda of the American system and capitalism and everything. Whereas I can speak to that propaganda somewhat because I watch movies and, you know, American propaganda is worldwide. But I can give an outsider's view. And I think there's two interesting stories to be told there. And yeah, maybe I was underplaying how important Lawton's Britishness was. I definitely thought there was a lot to be said about repressed sexuality because of him being closeted gay. Yeah. And I thought that was definitely coming through. Maybe self-hate, you know, coming through this through the screen, which was, I think, tremendously sad. But I didn't really pick up on the Britishness. So that's an interesting angle. And I think there's a lot to be said for it, that outside voices do sometimes give the most insight. We have talked a little bit, like, we've already talked about influence and things, and Andy, you gave a laundry list of a who's who of directors that have been, you know, the Mount Rushmore of directors that have been influenced by this thing. And it's just fascinating to me that it wasn't well received at the time by critics or audiences, which was an interesting behind the scenes fact that I found. I also love that it was a dummy, because I was worried for Shelley Winters. I genuinely, for a bit there, I was genuinely like, is she under the water? It's like, is that?
Did they make her hold her breath?
Yeah, I thought I saw a bubble. You know, I thought I saw a bubble come from her mouth. I'm like, that is her. She's under. Like, I was very confused for a while. Much like Don Beddo, who plays Mr. Spoon, he was genuinely convinced as well, apparently. But there are a couple of my favorite behind the scenes things. Andy, do you have anything that caught your eye?
I mean, it's more about the way in which it's being constructed that I connected with it. So the detail and the care that has gone into the shots, even though, as Ian mentioned earlier, they were mostly planned out the night before. I just think it is an outstanding undertaking for a first-time director, and to have had no track record and to have made this bold a film. You know, it doesn't just sort of bow to genre convention. It's not a typical thriller. So I think that kind of feeds into the initial failure of it. If you know, you look at the critical reception, you know, there's, you've hit on a couple of things already, like the fact that you had the small person on a pony force perspective for Charles Lawton, for Robert Mitchum.
Yeah,
I think that it's just a mammoth undertaking for this first time director who absolutely knocked it out of the park, and it's such a shame that this is the one film that he ever did.
Yeah. Yeah. I really wish he'd gotten the chance to do it again. A lot of the people who worked with him had really wonderful experiences working with him, and you can imagine that they would have been eager to collaborate again. It seemed like they had a really good system going. They probably could have made some great films together if they had been allowed to, but they ran over budget and the distributor didn't really know how to market the movie. It was a bit of an odd duck at the time. I mean, that's unfortunately the downside sometimes if you make something unlike any other movie that's coming out in your era, then sometimes audiences don't find it or don't, you know, don't respond well to it right away, but eventually it found an audience. I mean, it certainly came to, I think, critical esteem and esteem within the filmmaking community relatively quickly, and has certainly found its audience over the years. It's stayed in the ether, you know, and the greater, you know, filmmaking and film loving discourse for all this time.
Yeah, for sure. Actually, one thing I do want to point out as well, that this film was different in a bunch of ways. And United Artists, you're right, they didn't know how to market this thing. They didn't know what to do with it and didn't do much, as it turns out. But they also certainly objected to the idea of Lawton and the producer Paul Gregory wanting key members of the crew to basically profit share in the film. So like the cinematographer, for example, had a 1% profit share on top of his salary for this film, and a bunch of key cast and crew also had profit share, which I think is very cool. I mean, I'm one of those daring, dirty commies. Yeah,
it was also like on a practical level, it was a big collaborative effort. I mean, the production designer and cinematographer and Charles Lawton, like they all learned things from one another. They all worked together. They all like got together the night before to figure out what they were going to shoot the next day and how to do it. Like it was a very collaborative effort.
Yeah. And well earned, I'm sure. Unfortunately, it didn't make much money, so they wouldn't have got much out of that profit share. But I do love the idea. And I do genuinely think crews are underpaid compared to talent, obviously. And when you have someone like RDJ making stupid bank on Avengers when, you know, Silvestri doesn't get much at all, you know, for his score, you sit there and think, well, you know, like what's fair there? I don't know. But anyway, well, that's a whole different argument. I'm a dirty commie, according to the 1950s in Hollywood.
You are, in so many ways. since you brought up the score, it would be remiss of me to not bring it up for The Night of the Hunter, because it uses a very sort of slowed down version of the hymn Leaning on the Everlasting Arms, and using that as Powell's sort of leitmotif is deeply, deeply unsettling, because it's a recognizable religious tune that's supposed to evoke comfort, but because it's been slowed down, it becomes menacing, and it is the sonic embodiment of false righteousness. Then on the flip side of that, Rachel Cooper's leitmotif is also Leaning on the Everlasting Arms, but she sings it gently and as a lullaby, and having the duality of those two things, you've got the same melody but absolutely opposing in their meaning. In the former, it's far more performative and predatory. In the latter, it's more nurturing and intimate. So even though it shares the same language, it's a very different spirit. And I love that, the use of that score for this film. Walter Schumann has managed to blend hymns and folk melodies and children's songs to make it sound like nothing else in the 50s.
Unfortunately, he died at the age of 44, a couple of years after this film was made. Had heart condition is what I've what I understand, and he died in hospital in 1958, which is really sad because I agree, this is great work. It's very thoughtful work. And, you know, at 44, that's the start of your career as a composer, really. You know, it's definitely the first half, generally speaking. So we probably missed out on a lot of great stuff from Walter Schumann, but alas, we did miss out. Before we get into MVPs, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you guys need to?
I mean, lots if you really want to, but going long as is. This is such a thematically rich film, alongside the visual elements and the technical elements of it.
Agreed.
I think that we could very easily sit here all night.
Let's not and say we did.
Let's do that.
My little behind the scenes note. There's actually a cool thing that I just learned today is that the author of the book that this was based on, I think his name is Davis Grubb. Apparently was in close communication with Charles Laughton in the pre-production process, essentially, and sent Laughton, I think like 100 sketches that he made of kind of like the images that he had in his head when he was writing certain sections. And a couple of the really notable shots that we made mention of, like the horizon shot with the rider on horseback, like that came from the author of the book. He basically storyboarded a couple of those shots for Laughton.
Wow. But I mean, I love that. I love that. So maybe an underrated influence on this film then, because I don't think people are really talking about Davis Grubb.
Yeah. Like I said, this was truly a work of collaboration.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, that makes MVP difficult. Maybe. I mean, you know, Ian, your general thing is to go for the director, especially of one of these sort of great, great films.
I mean, the flip side of that is he also, like, even though James Agee is credited with the screenplay, he really just delivered like a pretty unwieldy first draft. And Laughton and the producers, like, they whittled down that script and got it into like an actual shooting script, but Laughton refused any writing credit.
I've heard that story, and I've heard slightly different ones as well that talk about how much influence James Agee had. But suffice to say that Laughton was absolutely definitely involved in writing, even though maybe that credit doesn't exist for sure. So he's obviously a great candidate for MVP. I think Robert Mitchum is a great candidate for MVP. Mm. I think Stanley Cortez, the cinematographer, is a great candidate for MVP. You mentioned Walter Schumann earlier there, Andy. I mean, Lillian Gish would also be a fine candidate for MVP, I think. The Doll, maybe. I don't know. we avoided that spoiler in the intro, but yeah, The Doll might get the MVP. Andy, who do you think is the MVP?
Well, I think that you've already named them because you kind of went through all the list of possibles. But for me, this is the greatest work of Robert Mitchum's career. Mm. He had such an air of menace on screen, and Laughton had nothing but positive things to say about him off screen. However, during production, Mitchum was struggling with alcoholism, addiction to drugs, and he became difficult. So I think his intensity in the film is very, very singular. So from a narrative perspective, I don't think that you could look past Harry Powell. So he's the axis on which this entire film rests. But from a technical perspective, Cortez frames him in the shadows and doorways or behind bars and uses that negative space around Mitchum. And yes, that very firmly puts Cortez in the conversation, but the control that Mitchum has over both his physicality as well as his voice, like it's a very measured delivery in his lines. It gives a very believable hypnotic approach to the preacher. So I think that for me, it absolutely has to be Robert Mitchum.
Yeah, I'm torn on this. Ian, what do you think?
I'm really torn. I kind of want to give it to multiple people. The thing...
It's most valuable person, not most valuable crew. So...
Most valuable...
P for people.
Yeah. People. Most valuable people. You know, the thing that I keep coming back to when it comes to Lawton is how a lot of the people who worked with him talked about the process of working with him. Generally speaking, people had a lot of really positive things to say about the process of making this movie. And that usually comes down to a good steady hand at director. I think that having a director with so much acting experience and experience directing actors was able to have a lot of, he was able to have a clear idea of what he wanted to get out of the people that he was using. And he had no ego about where good ideas about the visual elements of the film, which he was less familiar with, he had no ego about where those good ideas came from and just applied the best solution to whatever problem came up. And I think that is an underrated ability for directors to have. And I think that he deserves credit for that. And so I will give it to Charles Lawton, but I'll acknowledge that it could go to Mitchum. It could easily go to Cortez. It could go to Hilliard Brown, the production designer. It really could go to a few different people in front of him, behind the camera.
Yeah, exactly. And my initial instinct on the first viewing was definitely Mitchum. I think on reflection, the thing I like the most about the movie is the photography. So I'm going to go with Stanley Cortez. And I don't think there's an incorrect answer. You know, like that's the thing. I think Mitchum is, yeah, killing it. And he was my initial instinct. Cortez, you mentioned, Andy, that... that it's Mitchum's greatest work. That's probably true. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking to myself, is this Cortez's best work? And honestly, I don't know, because The Magnificent Ambersons is so hard to get like a full decent copy of, you know, it's like one of those lost-ish films. So I don't know if I've seen his best work or not, but this is the best work I've seen him do, for sure. So yeah, I've got to give it to Stanley Cortez, I think. And Charles Lawton's obviously on the podium. But yeah, I mean, like, as you say, Ian, it's definitely a collaborative medium. And this was about as good an example of that as we can think of,
yeah,
of films we've covered this year. And just quietly, as like a salivation for the draft that's coming up, 1955 is going to be very curious about how people go with that one, because it's some great movies we've covered this year and some movies we haven't covered this year that, and I think this one will end up in there between the four of us. I think someone's going to pick The Night of the Hunter, and I
could do.
Quietly can't wait for the draft.
Well, I mean, you think this was a flop, right? And part of the reason for that is it was out against Rebel Without a Cause and Mr. Roberts and To Catch a Thief. It was up against some films that we still talk about as great.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not even factoring in international cinema. Mm-hmm. Last time we spoke, Ian, you mentioned Patha Panchali, which I'll fight you for it.
That's going to come down to who gets to draft.
Gets there first. Yeah.
Yep.
Maybe. And there are other years to worry about too. So if you are listening, please keep an ear out for that. And just want to say thanks so much to everybody that's listening in, and thank you, of course, to the panel, Andy Williams and Ian Buckley, for your time this Friday evening and afternoon in your part of the world. We hope you enjoyed the show, anyone that's listening. If you have, please subscribe. We'd love to have more listeners, and obviously give a rating and a review wherever you can if your podcast app allows it. While you are in your podcast app, you should check out the show notes. There should be some links in there where you can find what other people are doing. I do Academy Watch. Ian does every show under the sun at the Film Stories Podcast Network. Illumination Above All if you're into Severance. We Are Starfleet if you're into Star Trek. And Collector's Commentary if you're into digital media collection and...
Physical media collection.
What did I say?
You said digital. Media.
Meant physical.
It's all digital. It's just on discs.
No, thank you for catching that. And Andy, you are often in charge of catching your co-host, Sean Wilson, when he starts going off on myriad tangents about film history, which he's very, very good at. Composer, expert, and famed author, Sean Wilson. So check out the other shows that we have with links in the show notes. Thanks again for your company, and see you for the next installment of Movieversaries.